So this is a tricky one, right? Economic hope versus economic reality. That is the broad outline of what we are going to do today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 8th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. At the risk of being that guy, I'm going to be that guy. Yes, there is talk now from actual responsible people about when this economy might be able to restart again, however slowly. And the stock market, insert appropriate caveats here, is feeling it. But look, there is real damage being done to the labor market, as we have been telling you, to small businesses by the tens or hundreds of thousands, and to bigger things, too. Global trade, for just one example. The World Trade Organization is out with a report today that says global trade in merchandise, basically stuff being shipped from one country to another, is going to fall this year anywhere from 13 to 32%. The WTO's Director General, a guy by the name of Roberto Acevedo, called those numbers ugly, which seems kind. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the global trade deterioration desk today.
Does it even matter if global trade falls by double digits this year? After all, as Columbia economist Sharon O'Halloran points out,
the U.S. is one of the more insulated countries from international trade.
Only about 30% of the domestic economy is directly connected to trade. But O'Halloran says companies that make planes, consumer electronics, and cars have an outsized impact on how much and how fast the U.S. economy can recover.
Our ability to bring in the supplies, reignite assembling in autos and so forth, requires inputs that are built abroad.
And if a major economy like the European Union's can't ship and sell its goods abroad,
it's going to have a hard time buying our goods.
Global supply chains have already been massively disrupted, says economist Mary Lovely at the Peterson Institute. First, factories shut down across Asia. Now they're reopening while Europe and North America are still shut down. So goods aren't moving off shelves and ports aren't moving goods out to sea.
And it's basically gumming up the works. We expect that we're going to see canceling of entire routes. And this is particularly going to hit trade between North America and Asia.
Those disruptions are hitting Driscoll's Berries, a worldwide fruit importer and exporter. Its business has fallen by at least 15%, says President Soren Bjorn.
We rely heavily on air freight. And a lot of times we fly in the bellies of passenger planes. Well, obviously, a lot of those planes are no longer flying. And so now we are left with a few cargo planes, which tend to be very, very expensive.
Bjorn says he's confident that if consumers recover their jobs and incomes, his company's berry sales will eventually rebound as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A lot of the stuff that gets traded globally is either steel, as in raw steel, or made out of steel, which puts us of a mind to call our steel person who is trying to run her company in a pandemic after trying to run her company in the middle of a trade war. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company. Lisa, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you, Kai.
So first of all, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I think here in the East, my county, which is Montgomery County, where I both work and live, we were one of the first counties in the country to completely just shut everything down after, I guess, Washington and New Rochelle. So we're old hat at this already.
I understand you've got like all your kids are home too and their spouses. I mean, it's like you're running a little WeWork there or something, right?
Right. I do call it our own little WeWork. One of my daughters is actually an executive at WeWork. So she's showing us how to get it done and we have our own spaces and people walk in and out and we're,
that's pretty funny.
It's definitely different. And much of it is really good. It's stressful and it's trying and it's difficult, but it's very, very cool.
Yeah, for sure. Do you feel like you have a grasp on the industry and your part in it right now, right? Because there's so many moving parts.
Right. I think that's the hardest part. My communication with my employees is really good, and I think their morale is decent. I'm a national company, coast to coast, North America. And this country is so spread out right now with its response to the virus. I am speaking with people in Arkansas that are literally business as usual. And I'm not being overly, you know, finger pointing or disparaging. Let their governor worry about them. But I've got other people that haven't gone near their plant in 3 weeks, and I've got people who are shipping every day. And so it's very difficult to have a handle on anything. If a customer places an order and they're in a state that isn't as proactive or responsive or active within the virus reality, then they think they're taking delivery. They'll give you a date of next Tuesday. They may not be realizing that on Monday they could be shut down. So it's very difficult to operate without a uniform experience. It's different from state to state, county to county, and industry to industry.
What does that tell you then about what a recovery when it comes, because it is going to come, but what does that tell you about what the recovery is going to look like?
I think the recovery is going to be just as bumpy and uncertain. Everyone's talking about what does coming up and starting again look like. And my point to everyone is we'll come up with a protocol on how to start again, of course, and hopefully soon. However, I think the new reality is going to look like an up-down, up-down experience. I think that you're going to, God willing, get back to work, and then you're going to have to shut down very quickly. You're going to have a surge in your area, or a member, you know, God forbid, of your team becomes ill and you have to handle everyone on site. Because until we have what they're calling herd immunity and until we have vaccines and all that, the new normal is going to be an up, down, up, down. It's not going to be a straight line, just like the crash, if you will, or the demise of the industry hasn't been a straight line down. It's unusually robust in certain areas and then, not surprisingly, kind of dead in other areas.
Lisa Goldenberg, she's the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Checking in as we always do. Lisa, take care of yourself. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Would you?
Stay healthy. Stay happy. Yeah. And peace.
We'll talk to you soon.
You bet.
Wall Street today was up again. And you might hear, oh, by the way, people starting to say we're in a bull market now. We're not. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the things that happens in a crisis is that the underlying flaws in whatever system is having the crisis become real, real clear. And this coronavirus economy is no exception. Black and Latino workers, who even in good times are at a disadvantage, are being hit by this crisis harder than most. To be clear, they are dying disproportionately. Experts say there are a lot of reasons for that. More pre-existing conditions in that population and existing biases in the healthcare system to begin with. But also, a lot of the frontline workers who have to show up in person every day are disproportionately Black and Latino. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has more on that.
Right now, people are being directed to shelter in place. But Dr. Stephen B. Thomas, director of the Maryland Center for Health Equity, says when he goes out to the grocery store,
who do I see out there working? Black and brown people. If they stay home, they don't eat.
Historically, African Americans are in lower paying jobs and have higher unemployment rates. Travon Logan is an economics professor at Ohio State University.
If you're someone who is employed, you really do want to show up for work because you're likely to have those in your household who are now unemployed.
At the center of the pandemic in New York City, frontline jobs like public transportation, postal services, and healthcare have mostly Black and Latino workers. Dr. Martha Dawson is the president of the National Black Nurses Association. She says she keeps hearing from nurses who have accidentally infected family members.
We have to get the equipment to the staff on the front line, and not just the nurses, but the environmental service workers, the food employees.
And it's also essential to get protection for people working outside hospitals. Again, Professor Logan.
Those working in grocery stores and food delivery and other interpersonal interactive occupations need personal protective equipment.
He says communities at risk will need more help than the one-time $1,200 stimulus check the government has announced, better health insurance, paid sick leave, and hazard pay. Experts say it's time to bring race into this conversation. Understand that even with prevention measures, race plays a role. Take something as simple, Dr. Thomas says, as telling people to cover their faces in public.
The first thing I thought of was Trayvon Martin. And all he had on was a hoodie. It's coming back to bite us now. But if we embrace it, we acknowledge it, we can manage to truly be all in this together.
He says COVID-19 is not the great equalizer, but it could finally get us to address inequality. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Uncertainty is pretty much the name of the game right now, right? In life, for sure, but also in this economy, including how bad it might get. Or in simpler terms, we talk in recession or depression. Last week, we asked some economic historians what we ought to be looking for.
Unemployment, of course.
Unemployment claims.
The unemployment rate.
Credit delinquencies.
Credit markets.
Credit for small businesses.
Significant and prolonged deflation.
Declining prices.
And bankruptcies.
That was Kathleen Day from Johns Hopkins, Carola Friedman, she's at Northwestern, and Eric Hilt is at Wellesley. We are taking those three indicators, deflation, unemployment, and credit, day by day this week. We did Deflation Tuesday, so today...
Unemployment, of course.
Unemployment claims.
The unemployment rate.
We got the March unemployment report this past Friday. You might remember that. The rate jumped up to 4.4%. That's from 3.5%. And we lost 701,000 jobs in a month. That's the first negative jobs number since 2010, the biggest drop since 2009. So, you know, not great. But is it depression territory? Here's Carola Friedman.
In the Great Depression, at its peak, unemployment rates were 25%.
So we're not there yet, but here's the thing about the Great Depression.
Unemployment rates remained very high for 10 years.
Which is a long time to wait to see if you're in a depression. So perhaps a more near-term indicator?
The very large number of unemployment claims is something that worries me. What I'm trying to think as I look forward is whether this is temporary change or whether this is something that's going to become more prolonged.
Unemployment claims here that she's talking about are those first-time claims for jobless benefits that we get every week, which in the past 2 weeks have told us that 10 million people lost their jobs at the end of March, which is crazy. It's also a national phenomenon. Record job losses from California to Maine, Illinois to Florida, and across the economy as well. Retail, entertainment, restaurants, and manufacturing, to name just a couple of industries. The new weekly number comes tomorrow. 2 weeks ago, it was 3.3 million. Last week, it was 6.6. Not taking any bets on what the next number in that sequence is going to turn out to be. But that rising tide of unemployment gets us to the structural damage that happens when so many people lose their jobs so fast, which we are going to talk about tomorrow. Depression indicator number three, credit and its deterioration. Coming up.
We are starting a campaign to attract people in the UK to come and help harvest our crops.
Desperate times call for desperate measures, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. The sad happy. Dow Industrials up 779 points today, 3.4%, 23,433. The NASDAQ boosted 203 points. 2.5%, 8,090. The S&P 500 rose 90 points, 3.4% there, 27.49. We talked to Lisa Goldenberg of Delaware Steel about how she's doing. So, bigger steel today. Steel producer Nucor fired up 4.6%. Steel Dynamics lifted more than 3% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. At last count, there were more than 500,000 homeless people in this country. There also happens to be right now thousands of hotel rooms just sitting there because ain't a whole lot of people traveling right now. So some cities and states are trying to move some of the most vulnerable of the homeless into those rooms, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Naresh Dadal owns two hotels in San Francisco. With almost zero bookings, he's had to furlough 60% of his staff. So when a city supervisor asked him to open some rooms to the homeless, he jumped at the chance. Each hotel now has 20 rooms occupied for $80 a night. And while that's less than half his base rate,
you know, to keep the doors open, have some staff working and keep the place going, you have to, you know, do anything to survive.
The state of California has a plan to use up to 15,000 other hotel rooms to house the homeless. FEMA will reimburse local agencies for up to 75% of the cost, including services like meals, laundry, and security. Kara Carnahan with Abode Services is leading the effort to convert two hotels in Oakland to temporary shelters for nearly 400 people. She set up a makeshift office in the Radisson Ballroom.
There's lots of people running around trying to meet the needs of our guests, trying to process clothing from the day before through a bed bug oven and trying to get more people into the shelter and housed this morning.
Other logistical challenges include training hotel and security staff to work with the new guests and making sure they have protective masks and other equipment. Leonard Beasley arrived at the hotel Monday with his girlfriend.
It's just like if you were to go and rent a room at the Holiday Inn or something without room service. But yeah, it's wonderful. It's a blessing.
Both of them are in their 60s and at higher risk of getting seriously ill. A recent study found that homeless people are much more likely to contract the coronavirus and to die from it than the general population. Co-author Dennis Culhane is a professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania.
People who are homeless are older in general. They have health conditions in their 50s that one would normally see in patients presenting in their 70s.
They also have higher rates of mental illness and addiction. Martha Cagle is executive director of the homeless services organization Unity in New Orleans, where so far more than 200 people have been moved to hotel rooms. Each has a case manager.
Because you don't want to just put very vulnerable people with disabilities in hotel rooms without somebody checking on them, stabilizing them, and really working on the next step to get them into permanent housing as soon as possible.
Congress has set aside billions of dollars for homeless assistance. Housing advocates worry a lot more people could become homeless because of the economic fallout from the pandemic. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The news from the UK today comes in two varieties, one main theme, I guess. First of all, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is still in intensive care, but his doctors say making steady progress. Also, and this kind of follows from that, I guess, the coronavirus is reshaping the British economy the same way it's reshaping ours. Case in point, agriculture. Brits are being asked to pick for Britain. The government is calling on students and people furloughed from their jobs and people without jobs to help pick the fruit and vegetables that could go to waste if not enough foreign workers are there for the harvest. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
British farmers are perilously dependent on seasonal workers from continental Europe. In the northern town of Tarleton, John Bragg told the BBC he cannot do without migrants to pick and process his salad crops.
If we can't get staff from the EU across here because there's some border issues or because the virus is causing a problem, all this crop in this field here will be left to rot and it won't be able to feed the UK nation during this difficult time.
It's many decades since large numbers of Brits harvested the country's soft fruit and vegetable crop. That's going to have to change to make up the shortfall of foreign workers, says Matt Jarrett of ProForce, which recruits seasonal farmhands.
We are starting a campaign to attract people in the UK, predominantly students, people out of work, to come and help harvest our crops and pack our crops.
The campaign carries an echo from earlier desperate days when the world was in another kind of war.
We'll meet again, don't know where.
During World War II, evoked most memorably in this song by Vera Lynn, Britain launched a campaign called Dig for Victory. Propaganda films urged the population to go back to the land, to plant and grow more fruit and vegetables, to keep the country fed.
Have you joined the ranks of this great new army that's helping to win the war by helping themselves to good food? Dig for victory.
Today's campaign, called Feed the Nation, has appealed online for British fruit and vegetable pickers, with some success, says one of the organisers, Rachel Hubbard of Fruitful Jobs, a farm labour supply firm.
Last night, over 18,300 people had applied via the website.
Some, it seems, motivated by altruism, many by economic necessity.
A lot have said that their jobs have been impacted by COVID-19, so they're looking for alternative work. A mixture of retired through to students and everything in between.
But 18,300 applicants won't fill the expected shortfall once the main picking season gets underway in May. And there are other snags. The farmers need people who can drive a tractor, operate harvesting equipment and pick produce fast. Not as easy as it seems. Then there's the more delicate question, will today's relatively pampered Brits be able to hack it? Matthew Spanton farms asparagus in Kent.
We're willing to give people a go and to train them up, but when we've got rain, it's cold in the morning and you've got to come back and it's a Sunday, I think this is where we struggle. It's relentless hard work.
Since the COVID-19 crisis deepened here, some politicians and the Queen herself have invoked the spirit of the Blitz, the ability to unite and survive in wartime. Whether enough Brits can endure the rigours of farm work will be another test of their mettle in this crisis. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We talked a bit yesterday about the commercial versus consumer changes that are happening in the food chain. Patrick Smith, our apples and hops farmer up in Washington State, and how his sales are changing now that people are buying for and eating from home. Turns out that change is affecting what we eat as well, with most of us home most of the time. Demand for ready-to-eat highly processed foods is going up, which is a bit of a 180 for those packaged foods brands, which had been getting passed over in favor of not processed, not packaged sustenance. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on that one.
Processed cheese food and canned soups are not trendy, but they're comforting.
Give someone a warm hug.
A warm hug from Campbell's.
And right now that warm hug sounds pretty good, says Diane Regasio-Radler, a nutrition professor at Rutgers University.
These are really disturbing times and very unsettled. And sometimes, you know, we reach for things that we're familiar with.
The familiar is getting a boost. Campbell's Soup, which also makes Pepperidge Farm Goldfish crackers and Prego pasta sauce, just saw a more than fourfold increase in orders. Kraft Heinz of Kraft Mac and Cheese fame is reporting sales increases too. Aaron Lash, a consumer sector analyst for Morningstar, says that's a big change.
So those established branded manufacturers that consumers are incredibly familiar with have been falling out of favor.
A lot of us had been opting for stuff like kale and quinoa and locally sourced meats, but packaged foods are often cheaper, giving established brands a new opening during the coronavirus shutdown, says food analyst Darren Seifer of the NPD Group.
Even when the pandemic starts to fade away, there's the economic impact that it had, and we just don't know what that's going to be.
In other words, the length and depth of the economic pain could determine how much and how long Americans will seek comfort and savings in their food choices. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's a quick twofer, commercial aviation in the age of coronavirus. Item one, Delta Airlines announced today it is going to block middle seats on its planes to allow for social distancing. A couple of other carriers have already done that, and it seems reasonable. Number two, though, Man, those planes are empty. I've been a tad obsessed, as you know, with the TSA's passenger throughput numbers, how many people it's screening every day. Yesterday, in the whole country, all of the United States, 97,130 people went through TSA checkpoints. A year ago yesterday, almost 2.1 million. Do you suppose, and this is a serious question, do you suppose that gets to zero ever? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 779 points today, 3.4%. The NASDAQ gained 203, 2.5%. S&P 500 up 99 or 0, 3.4% there. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. Once again, because that ought to be said out loud every week, these are the folks going into the studios so we all can stay safe and get the show on the air. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.